The Guardian.
Hello, John Dennis here with Guardian Weekly for September the 10th. News and comments from around the world. This week, as Pakistan swears in the late Benazir Bhutto's husband as its new president, Jason Burke assesses the challenges facing Asif Ali Zardari.
The Pakistani population are largely and increasingly anti-Western and anti-American.
Markets react positively after US taxpayers bail out America's biggest mortgage lenders, Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae.
Freddie and Fannie were teetering close to the brink of collapse.
And a freewheeling time, Susie Rotolo on New York's Greenwich Village in the 1960s and her life as Bob Dylan's muse.
His songs from that period are really timeless because they had a universal tone to them. They weren't just newspaper articles written in rhyme.
Asif Ali Zardari, husband of the assassinated former Pakistani Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto, has been sworn in as the country's president. The most powerful civilian to hold the office for many years, he faces a growing threat from Islamist militants and an economic slump. Zardari was elected by the political establishment and not the Pakistani people. The Observer's Jason Burke says that ordinary Pakistanis haven't got much enthusiasm for Zardari.
There's not much enthusiasm among the general Pakistani population for any politician. Of the politicians in Pakistan at the moment, Zardari is one of the least popular. He's seen as something of a chancer. The various allegations of corruption against him have stained his reputation. Many people remember the period in the 90s when Benazir Bhutto, his wife obviously, was in power, a period that was associated and is certainly associated in the popular memory with political instability, a degree of mismanagement, economic chaos, and so forth. So overall, it's fair to say that he's hardly being welcomed with open arms.
He faces enormous challenges, of course. Islamist insurgents on the rise, economic problems. What hopes are there that he can bring stability to Pakistan and revive the economy?
Not many. It's certainly the case that Pakistan is always faced by a whole variety of difficult challenges and shows remarkable resilience. If you look at how many major shocks the state has absorbed in the last 18 months, numerous suicide bombs, the assassination of a major political figure, an effective legislative coup, etc., it's astonishing that you don't see more chaos than you actually do. A lot depends on the regional situation. A lot depends on Washington. Zardari's own room for manoeuvre is relatively limited given the strength of the military establishment in Pakistan. For the moment, the army are staying on the sidelines, watching, waiting. But there's no doubt that at some later date they'd be prepared to step in if they felt that Zardari was in some way threatening what they deem to be the national security interests of Pakistan.
Last week, US troops based in Afghanistan crossed the border into Pakistan to carry out raids on what they said were Taliban targets. Will Zardari allow a repeat of that?
Zardari is in a very difficult position. He needs to please Washington because he needs the money that Washington are paying the Pakistani army and the economic aid they're delivering. He needs their support at the IMF, the World Bank. Every place he's going to be going to beg for economic help in the months that are coming. At the same time, the Pakistani population are largely and increasingly anti-Western and anti-American. And like any nation, most people don't take too kindly to troops from another country crossing onto their land for whatever reason. So he's in a very difficult position. He's got to tread a very, very tight path between pleasing the international community or largely the West and cooperating in the way that they want him to cooperate in the war on terror and risking popular wrath, if you like, in being seen to be, as General Musharraf, his predecessor, eventually was, a stooge of the West.
Jason Burke. The US government has bailed out the Federal Home Loan Mortgage Corporation, nicknamed Freddie Mac, and the Federal National Mortgage Association, known as Fannie Mae. The two companies account for half of all mortgages in the US, and the bailout, like that of Northern Rock in the UK, is in effect nationalisation, though supposedly for a limited period. Our economics correspondent, Ashley Seeger, told The Guardian's Belinda Rhodes why markets had reacted so positively to the news.
Well, I think markets hate uncertainty, and they'd been worried about Freddie and Fannie for some time because the two institutions were clearly in trouble. And Henry Paulson had taken powers in July to make this move, and it means that the government has extended its lender of last resort facility ultimately to the entire US mortgage market. It means US mortgage rates should fall. It's an encouraging step, if you like, if you're a bank that hasn't been able to lend any mortgages for a long time and are worried about not doing any business. This ends a great deal of that uncertainty. That's why, you know, stock prices in banks have soared everywhere around the world.
This was obviously a huge step for the American government to take. What might have happened if they hadn't done it?
Well, I think Freddie and Fannie were teetering close to the brink of collapse. They were institutions that arguably have run their course and shouldn't exist any longer, and for certain won't exist in anything like the form they are now once they come out of conservatorship, as it's called. So there was a very real danger that they would collapse, and that would bring down, really bring down, the financial system in the US and probably around the world as well, since so many banks globally hold these mortgage-backed securities that we've heard so much about during the credit crunch.
And US Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson had battled to prevent this happening. How much of an embarrassment is it to the government?
Is it an embarrassment? I don't know that it's an embarrassment, really. Certainly there were figures that came out on Friday about the extent of arrears and foreclosures in American mortgages that were so bad that I think they were probably the final straw that made the government act. They were really awful numbers on Friday. And I think the government just thought, we've got to act. You could say it's 3 months before an election, you could be cynical, but for certain you wouldn't want, as Treasury Secretary Paulson knows that if Obama wins, he's only got 3 or 4 months left in power. So I think he didn't want to be the man who saw Freddie and Fannie collapse on his watch, if you like.
And speaking of Obama and John McCain, one of them will be president, Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson briefed them about what he was doing. How did they react?
Well, McCain said he was positive about it and it had to be done. Obama said he would reserve judgment to see whether taxpayers were protected. They do look protected, I must say. It's shareholders that have been wiped out in this. The government has essentially taken over these two bodies for nothing. There are signs that the American housing market is bottoming out. If it increases and business picks up for Freddie and Fannie, then the taxpayer will sit on a very healthy profit potentially in a year or two. So while Obama is right to be worried about taxpayers, we don't want taxpayers to pay for the folly of these lending institutions. But it does look like they may come out of it okay.
And looking ahead, this conservatorship, as you mentioned, in effect temporary nationalisation, supposed to be temporary, how easy will it be for the government to return Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae to the private sector?
Well, that will depend on the health of the housing market, and that this move is designed to sort of put a floor, as I mentioned, under prices. So it will depend to a great extent on how quickly financial markets more generally and the US housing market in particular return to some sort of normal state. But there's no doubt that Freddie and Fannie will not return to the private sector in the form that they were taken in from the private sector in it. They were an anomaly, an anachronism. They should have been got rid of years ago. They were just so big that they could employ the best lobbyists in Washington to keep them alive. But really, in a world of big, broad capital markets, there's no need for these kind of institutions. We don't have them in Britain, and you don't have them generally elsewhere in the world. We won't see Freddie and Fannie in the same condition, the same state again. They are finished, essentially, as they were. They've died, in a way.
Ashley Seeger talking to Belinda Rhodes. My name's John Dennis. This is Guardian Weekly. Coming up, Susie Rotolo talks to us about her life with Bob Dylan and the shocking treatment of children in Baghdad's prisons. But first, there's been a lot of vitriol directed at Sarah Palin since the Republican presidential candidate John McCain announced her selection as his running mate in the US election campaign. But our foreign affairs columnist Simon Tisdall says that not only has Palin survived the attacks, she's also galvanised Middle America and given the McCain campaign a significant boost in the polls.
Well, since she sort of broke onto the American electoral scene, she's had everything but the kitchen sink thrown at her. And this is partly a measure of the Democrats' surprise. They weren't expecting this pick, and most of them never heard of her. So they went after her on quite personal grounds, which has now rebounded on them. For instance, they questioned her ability to run as a vice president and be the mother of five children, one of them who has special needs. They immediately picked on her inexperience, as they see it, of a two-year governorship in Alaska. Of course, that's 2 years more in executive office than Obama's ever had, but nevertheless, they saw that as a weakness. They also hit on her socially conservative views, her anti-abortion stance, other issues to do with family matters and so on. They tried to portray her as an extremist or as a right-wing fringe nut, and her moose hunting hobbies and other field sports interests have only fed that kind of mockery, which was taken up by the Democrats' cheerleaders in the East Coast media, who should know better.
Because really, it only gives strength to the Republicans' accusations that Obama and the Democrats are elitist, because a lot of middle America, especially women voters, will look at Sarah Palin and see themselves.
I think they have run into that difficulty, and I think they haven't found a way out of it yet. After all, she is a woman on the ticket. It's the first time either party, Geraldine Ferraro accepted, has had a woman on a major ticket. It's something the Democrats decided not to do in the end, against the wishes of 18 million people who voted for Hillary Clinton in the primaries. So there's a whole issue of sexism and gender prejudice there. But it also does, as you say, play into the Republican charge that Obama is not representative of the American people, and the people around Obama are not representative of the ordinary American people. Indeed, they're elitist, they're out of touch, they look down on them. Obama's comments a few months ago about the bitterness of the white working class are recalled. It's done him no favours in terms of boosting his broader appeal to the electorate.
A poll this week from USA Today and Gallup gave John McCain and Sarah Palin a 4-point lead over Barack Obama and Senator Joe Biden. What's the best way now for the Democrats to regain the momentum?
Well, I've been looking at the polling figures overnight, and now the average poll of polls, as it were, the national polls all averaged out, give McCain, Palin a 2.9 lead nationally. On average. As you say, some polls give an even bigger margin, ranging from 10% to McCain to a tie, but no polls are now showing Obama in the lead, which is a really big turnaround from only 2 weeks ago, and must mostly be attributed to Palin's arrival on the ticket, because McCain didn't do himself any great favours with his convention speech. And of course, the convention itself was disrupted by Hurricane Gustav. What can Barack Obama do? Well, he's got angry. He was up in Michigan accusing Palin and McCain of lying. He said they were shameless people. He said that they were not telling the truth. They were taking the American people as stupid. They were presenting themselves as agents of change, which, of course, is his big theme, when, of course, they were just part of the same old Republican gravy train that's ruled most of Washington for most of the last two or three decades. And he's going on the offensive. He knows, I'm sure, his advisors are telling him, he must try and ride out this post-convention bounce that McCain's obtained and regain the initiative quickly, because at the moment the polls are heading the wrong way for him.
Simon Tisdall. Children as young as 9 are being held in appalling conditions in Baghdad's prisons. They're sleeping in 100-degree temperatures in overcrowded cells without working fans or daily access to showers. And they're also regularly sexually abused by guards. The Guardian's been speaking to current and former prisoners. Here's our senior foreign correspondent, Jonathan Steele.
The heat there is the worst problem at the moment. The temperatures in Baghdad are around 112 degrees Fahrenheit by day. They hardly drop below 100 degrees or 40 degrees centigrade by night. The electricity, which is supposed to fuel the fans, doesn't work. It's only put on for 2 hours a week. That's on Sunday when the visitors come in. And as one of these young men said, for about 2 or 3 hours in the evening, but not during the night. The inmates suspect that the guards are actually selling the fuel for the generator on the black market. So they could have electricity, but they're not getting it. They also say that the guards occasionally allow one or two of them to telephone home on their cell phones, but the guards demand that the families of the boy top up the phones with $10 or $20 each time. And, of course, very often they don't let them use the phone. So these kids are completely isolated in this terrible heat. Some of them have awful skin sores from lying in these sweat-soaked mattresses. They're sweating profusely all night in this heat. The boy who we visited said that he only gets access to a shower once every 3 days because the water supply is not adequate. So you can imagine the conditions. And some children are actually sleeping on the floor. Others are in double bunks, rows of double bunks. but it's so overcrowded that some are actually sleeping on the concrete floor.
What sort of crimes are these young people supposed to have committed?
Well, a few are for petty offences, criminal offences, but a large number are for security offences. But the evidence that they were really taking part in some terrorism at that young age, because some of these children are as young as nine, must be a little bit dubious. The trials are not properly conducted. And we know that there has been a lot of sectarian prejudice and unfairness perpetrated, particularly by the Iraqi police, who are largely Shia-dominated. Most of these kids are Sunnis, and they are rounded up as part of this general sectarian violence that has been going on for the last two or three years in Baghdad.
The United Nations has expressed its concern about conditions in Iraqi jails. What has been the official response to this?
The Ministry of Labour and Social Affairs, which is in charge of these two prisons, say that they have no money to improve conditions, and they do the best they can. It's extraordinary that they can't find more money to deal with this desperate problem. The Iraqi government is sitting on billions of dollars of revenue from oil exports, and they're not spending it. The United States is spending billions of dollars on upgrading the Iraqi military and the Iraqi police. Couldn't they spend $1 million or two? It can't require very much money to have decent cooling facilities and improve the living conditions for these young men.
Jonathan Steele. Bob Dylan's second album, 1963's The Freewheeling Bob Dylan, included socially conscious songs such as Blowin' in the Wind and A Hard Rain's Gonna Fall. They propelled Dylan from New York's tight-knit folk music scene to a wider audience. The intimate photograph on the album's cover depicted the 21-year-old singer walking through a wintry Greenwich village with his then 18-year-old girlfriend Susie Rotolo. Well, 45 years later, Susie Rotolo, Dylan's close companion and muse, is telling her story in a new book.
The cover photograph of Freewheeling, it's become such a symbol that to actually recall what that day was like and what the circumstances surrounding it were like was odd, because I almost felt as if I'd betray something by describing what it was like, because it meant so much for so many people. But then a good story is a good story, and it just unfolded rather casually. There were no pictures of Bob Dylan on file at Columbia Records, now Sony, and at that time they had staff photographers, and Don Hunstein was a staff photographer, and he was told to go down to this apartment in the village and take some pictures, possibly for a record album cover, but just to have some pictures of this young man who's a rising star, if they even said it that way. And he came in this little apartment and began taking pictures of Bob. He'd say, sit here, pick this up, hold the guitar, put it down. And then he pointed to me and said, you sit with him or stand around. And it was all very casual. Nothing was planned. And at those years, most album covers were staged and very austere or stylized. In this case, it was extremely informal. Someone ought to know, give credit to that art director who chose the cover for the album, because it was really breaking with tradition. The photographer told us, well, let's go outside. And it was a snowy, cold winter day, and it was afternoon, so there wasn't much light. And he said, walk around, and we did. And it was freezing, really freezing. After all these years, it's easy to see that if you look closely. Our noses are red, and we're huddled into each other, more to keep warm than anything else.
Well, your book is not only just the story of you and Bob Dylan, but it's also the story of Greenwich Village in the 1960s. And the folk music scene and civil liberties activism went very much hand in hand at that time, didn't they?
Exactly. They certainly did. It was all of a piece. And at that time, the rebellious music, if that's the right word, was folk music, because it dealt with from an earlier generation in the 1930s, from the Great Depression. And it was Woody Guthrie who was a spokesperson, and Pete Seeger. And the folk music that was starting to happen in the 1960s was beginning to write music about the time the folk musicians were living in, and Bob was at the beginning of that. I think he was one of the first who began writing about his own time, instead of just, which everyone was doing, was either singing the traditional songs in a traditional manner or singing the old union songs of Woody Guthrie and Pete Seeger. it suddenly became, well, we're living now. I don't know whether it was conscious or not, but people began writing about their own time in the tradition of Woody Guthrie, but Bob kind of broke through that. And very much in his songs from that period are really timeless because they had a universal tone to them. They weren't just newspaper articles written in rhyme.
And you yourself were a big inspiration for many of Bob Dylan's early songs. I mean, how is it for you now to listen to those songs when you find it painful to listen to them?
It's not painful. I find it odd because they're very much songs coming out of his life and certainly my life and what was going on in those years. But they're also his ability as an artist to make them, as any writer does, you take from your life and you alter it to fit the song you're writing or what it is you're writing. So they're not literal songs, and I hate it when Dylanologists want to dissect the song. I mean, an example is Boots of Spanish Leather, which is such a perfect example of the story that I was in Italy then, not in Spain, and it has nothing to do with Spanish boots. You follow? So it's, I think it's a perfect example showing an artist at work. He takes a situation, an emotional story, and makes a ballad out of it, makes a song out of it that tells another story but reflects the emotion.
You describe Bob Dylan as a beacon and a black hole. Could you tell us what you mean by that?
If you think people are drawn to somebody because of their intensity and their charisma and their ability to draw attention to themselves, and there's something very intense about him, and you could fall right into a black hole, the light would lead you and then you'd fall in, because it was very much his world and his way of being that was essential. At that time, I was a young girl, and we were a couple in love. It's a private thing, but yet he was becoming a very public person, and people were drawn to him. It was very disorienting for me. I didn't have many tools in how to cope with it, but I just knew it wasn't for me. I couldn't live that way.
The book is also about your struggle to be independent of Bob Dylan and not, as you put it, just a string on his guitar.
Yes. Yes, that was it. That's how I would feel. And it's funny, in before the language of feminism, maybe I could have been helped by seeing the situation more clearly. I just felt this horrible rage when people would refer to me as, oh, you're Bob's chick. And I couldn't stand it. I couldn't stand being called a chick. I felt like I wasn't a person. But I had no words for it. It was just this rage and this fury. And I'd say to people, don't you dare call me a chick. But I had nothing to follow that, which now, of course, women do.
Susie Rotolo, many thanks for talking to us. A Freewheeling Time, a memoir of Greenwich Village in the 60s by Susie Rotolo, is published by Aurum Press. Now, I know what you're thinking. What's in the latest print edition of Guardian Weekly? Well, NATO has issued new military rules of engagement in Afghanistan, hoping to curb the number of civilian deaths. And the shift comes after an airstrike last month, which reportedly killed 90 people, many of them children. Human Rights Watch says civilian deaths in Afghanistan from US and NATO airstrikes have nearly tripled in the last year, and that recent bombings have led to more killings. We consider the public backlash that this is fueling against US and other forces in the country. Our US diarist Ed Pilkington tackles the Republican running mate Sarah Palin. He says she may have energised middle America with her gun-toting hockey mom persona, but her stance on weapons, religion and global warming makes a mockery of the candidate John McCain's beliefs and may well turn out to be McCain's ultimate humiliation. And our sister paper, Le Monde, reports on reunification talks in Cyprus, a divided island where hopes for peace are blossoming among the military barracks and cordoned-off beaches. All that's at guardianweekly.co.uk. If you subscribe now, you can get 4 free issues. This week's Guardian Weekly podcast was produced by Ian Chambers. My name's John Dennis. Thank you for listening.
Great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.